Full show and tell. This video is a biography of Richard Wilhelm. It just came out. And Cal told me about it about a month ago. And Kathy reminded me about it about a week ago, and I ordered it. I finally found it. It wasn't available.
Good old
so Barnes & Noble had it, yeah. So you get it first, and then you get it second, then you can fight over it.
Okay.
It's very good. I was surprised. How sensitively it was done. There's only one little point we could discuss it if you watch it, but it talks about his relationship to Jung. And,
great.
It's very, I was surprised. I was expecting some schluck, you know.
Yeah, thing. But she did it herself and she's a filmmaker.
Yeah, she's a filmmaker and she's his granddaughter.
Yeah.
Well, I may be in Italy by the time we have class next, so if someone else wants to do it before
okay.
me.
Yeah, maybe keep it a week, pass it around if you want to watch it. It's an hour and a half.
Did you know that Wilhelm edited a book of Chinese fairy tales?
He apparently did a lot of stuff.
I've got it, and it's from Dover Press. You know that they make all the imagery books.
Right. Right.
Well, anyway, Dover Press has his book of Chinese fairy tales.
He translated many texts. He's got about five or six major Taoist texts.
Yes. I guess this is just for general mythology, but I thought it might be interesting to see exactly which tales he gravitated toward.
Yeah, be very interesting. You know, I don't know enough about it to really assess, but this next generation of Jungians, they always know better, right? And, of course, they criticize his translation. But it was interesting, the way he did it, he got the text. He translated it into German, put it aside, retranslated it into Chinese, gave it to one of the premier Taoist scholars,
right.
And then they discussed the translation. Mm-hmm. So that tells me it's pretty darn good.
Right. That's what I read, too, that he worked with that premier Taoist scholar, and how can you argue with that?
And to go from German, Chinese to German, German to Chinese is an astounding accomplishment. Yeah, so.
That was just to check his understanding of the text.
Did he understand the text?
Yeah.
And I guess he must have been fluent in Chinese and a great lover of Chinese culture. And really involved in the politics of, when the Japanese invaded, of negotiating Chinese rights and things like that. Yet a tragic figure in the end, as you'll see. The other thing, Carl brought a question which I had thought about before, but never really researched. What did Freud use for ego? He did not use the word ego. He used the word das Ich. So did Jung. I went back to some of Jung's works. I don't have many of them, a couple of them in German. I have Memories in German, and I have some others in German. Ego is a term from the English translator James Stretschke or something like that. It does not exist in the German. So really when we say ego, we really should be saying I. It makes a lot more sense to me. Yeah. I've done this.
Yeah. Or the I. Mm-hmm.
Or the I. Das ich.
Yeah.
Das is just the. And ich is I. So you say like, ich gehe, I go. It's I. So thank you for that, Carl. But very interesting how these things get changed around. And apparently, I don't know if you know this guy, Bruno Bettelheim. He was sort of a child psychiatrist. He lambasted the interpretations of Freud and said it's watered down and it's lost its verve. So for what it's worth, that might be an example.
Oh, when we were discussing this woman on page 339 that Jung encounters, she draws near and made a soft whirring sound, the whirring of the wings of the sun beetle. And I had been reading this book by Ann Carson called Eros, the Bittersweet, where she discusses wings, especially with regards to how the ancient Greeks saw that symbolism as a carrier of Eros or of our true nature. So what I did was just put together three pages of quotes from the book, and you can take a look at them and see what you think. So. She starts out, just to preface it a little bit, describing in the oral tradition this concept of phrenes, P-H-R-E-N-E-S, which was breath. They also thought of it as consciousness, or even the lungs were to carry everything from your emotions to your intellect. And she builds upon that, where words could be winged or unwinged, whether they were spoken or kept inside. So anyway, she builds on that, and she gives some examples of writers and philosophers of the time and their thoughts and feelings. So I just wanted you to have it. It's very interesting to
me. Thank you.
It really makes and enriches all those images of winged creatures from the ancient world. So,
this is great.
You're welcome.
Will you be here next time? You'll be here next time.
Yeah, we'll be here next
time. Traipsing around the world.
We'll be here next time. Will we miss this class at all?
Yeah, we miss this class, but we don't miss
the Saturday.
Well, why don't we read it at home, and then we can discuss it if you like. Next time, you'll be here.
Okay. Are we missing anyone? No. Thanks. You're welcome.
Thank you.
Going to look at this in light of...
Linda, how's your daughter?
If I'm learning about oncology treatment, I knew nothing about it. But she's acclimated to the drug, which is called interferon, and she has, after the day, 6 months. She finished the thing with meaning infusion a week from tomorrow, and then she'll be on shots.
Oh, shots.
Of which she can, of course, give herself. But she was telling Anne understands, see, so well, this doctor she called him and said, I'm not going to be off the prescribed 2 weeks between intravenous and shots, because then that will give my body a chance to get away from the interferon that I'll have to go through getting acclimated. Which is just devastating. She's been with her at a hospital. So she said, I'm only taking a week off. And so Dan said, that's really great. He agrees with her then, if that's what you want. She said, because now I'm acclimated and I'm tolerating it well. Now I don't want to be away from it. Because these shots, she just told me last night, will last for 11 months. So, and then that'll be the end of the
11 more months. So.
11 months. She had told me she'd be on this drug for a year.
That's what you said, yeah. So that's not true, huh? Well, that
so
is true,
yeah,
actually. Yeah,
because she's been on
for a month, yeah.
And so that'll be... I just would think, and some of you that have had this experience would probably agree, not that, because I was warned when you go into cancer center, then she goes to community hospitals, it's just south of the hospital, that is so demoralizing because there are people there that really have a very limited time to really make their problems. So that, you know, she'll just be given the drug and she can administer the drug to herself. So she won't have to go, and she's not driving yet, so it has to be driven. And just look, and she's a lot stronger. I told her she's ordering them around. So I know she's getting better and all of this and all of that. So that's, so I say, well, you know, but I'm really glad you're here.
Well, good. We're sending her our thoughts and prayers.
Thank you.
I have been racking my brains. What is the meaning of this new section, the scrutinies? Why a new section? What does that mean, scrutiny? At first I thought it was a reflection back on what we have done, but actually it presents material not unlike the stuff we've already done. But I think I finally figured it out. So I thought I'd just go back very quickly and review what he's done in the scrutinies. Remember, he starts off beating himself up. And then on 335, the question emerges of the relationship between the soul slash bird in the earth. In other words, how am I going to take what I've just understood and make it real? Then the image of the dead appears, and I wasn't quite sure how to take that. It could be all of these, actually, that he feels responsible for helping bring people to life, that his job as a psychiatrist is to deal with psychologically dead people. And then there's the issue of all the dead in the war. And the other idea, which I think tends to take precedent, is this idea of the dead truths of the past seeking to be reinterpreted in the present. That brought up the discussion of sharing that, and therefore the issue of compassion, where he reflects, well, it's nice to give, and that's something I have to do. But on the other hand, if you give people things, what you do is you inhibit their desire to get it, their ability to get it for themselves. So it actually makes people passive. That would be our codependence. That's the buzzword today. Then he moved on to a discussion of the self, because the self would be the place where we start. And if we're going to give, make sure we've given to ourselves first. Otherwise, our giving is often demanding a response to from other people that we really should be giving to ourselves. So that was kind of the summary. Then where we left off last time was this ghost woman. And I think she we could take as the past truths. We saw that way back when Jung was about ready to give up Christianity because he was sickened by that Thomas A. Kempis imitation of Christ. And he's saying, well, that's stupid. You should be yourself, not imitate somebody else. And he's about ready to dump it all, and then all these past forms came, and they were the past Christian lives, and he realized, I can't get rid of Christianity. I have to reinterpret its truths. Something we did touch on, but I really didn't quite grasp the significance last time, but the more I thought about it, I believe this begins to be the answer to my question. Why does he name this section of scrutinies? And that is, on 339, just a little bit above where we stopped in the second column, this idea of the symbol comes up. Now, as far as I, part of the problem with doing this book, you have to remember, did we talk about this already? I don't think we did explicitly talk about symbolism. So just make a note, that's a new theme. Then we had the image of Hap. I looked up, why is Hap capitalized? I couldn't find anything. I don't know. Other than to express its importance. I thought, and we also saw how Hap, he related to the phallus. We'll come back to that today.
So Hap is the symbol.
I wouldn't.
The form of chaos.
I don't think so.
That is it. That is Hap, the symbol that we discussed.
I guess it is the symbol. I was thinking more of the symbol creator.
Well, phallus is pretty symbolic.
Yeah. Okay. I have to accept what he says.
Yeah, because he goes down further and says he is the flesh spirit, the blood spirit. So he would be this symbol speaking through matter, the symbol in matter.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, you've already touched on the point where I'm going. Up to now, we'll try to follow this through today. Matter has spoken directly through the young girl with the old man, and these shimmering female images like Salome throughout the story. he, you know, remember he was going to go off and be an anchorite. Oops, he's a pretty girl. Can't do that. I think what we're seeing now, he's getting an understanding that Eros and the body is a symbol. And in the...
Say that again, Gary. Eros and the body
is a symbol.
As a symbol? Is that what you're saying?
It is a symbol. That he was drawn to his creativity, which lifted him into thought. And then these women, these female figures, always pulled him back. But it was a female figure. It was a woman, like Tony Wolf. And in a way, he was at their mercy. Now I think he's going to gain strength vis-a-vis them. And I think we'll see that today.
Because now he has the male
equivalent. He's got an understanding of what they've had to offer, which he can then turn back through his creativity and hold his own against them.
So he understands his experience with them through the symbol of Hap, the blood spirit. That's how he brings it to his male understanding.
Yeah, I couldn't disagree with that, no. Remember we had that statement, sometimes one is allowed by the gods to substitute wine for blood, but that will come later. That was in the visions. We talked about how some experiences you have to live, some you can work through in imagination. And I think what he's getting to is the point where he can work it through in imagination. He had to live it before. And he's getting to the point where he can live it in imagination and turn back to the anima and start critiquing her. Not just see what she has to offer, but also see how destructive she can be.
Could you say before he was overwhelmed by her, and
yes,
now he can be in relationship, in a reciprocal relationship,
yes,
with her, which is the proper function of
that. Absolutely. And that's what he's scrutinizing. Because I said to myself, Hap, we've had him before. Remember? We had Telesphorus and Phanes. We went through all that stuff of Salome and Philemon, and then the old man and the young girl, and then all these images of death. And then these male figures started to be born. I think it was Izdubar. And then Izdubar died, and then out of that came these young male figures, which were all phallic gods. So I said to myself, why are we back there? And I think the reason we're back there is more of a spiral. And we've come back to that point, but now, and this is something, if I ever would work this whole thing out, I think I may have found a key here. Each turn of the spiral, which has been, you know, Philemon and Baucis and the old man and the younger, that's the same thing. Why do we have to keep coming back to these things? Because at each turn of the spiral, a new element is integrated. And what's integrated now that we're back to Hap or Phanes, it's the same figure, again, is a strength to critique the anima. That's why it's called scrutiny. And I think we'll see now how he does that. That's in the text. And we'll see him acting today in a way that he's never acted before. I would really call that integration. To the average man, either turns his wife into a mother and completely abandons the struggle with desirousness, just gives it up, or cheats on her and lives out Eros. But remember that, I think we had it in the Windows on Eternity. It burns, but it gives no light. There's no understanding that ever comes out, so it's repeating. And what he has done, he went with the Eros, and now we're seeing him develop a perspective on it. So it's no longer controlling him, no longer overwhelming him. In a way, as you're doing Windows, this is what beer crews are struggling with to get to that point. Why is that so important? Because creativity comes through Eros.
You know, I don't think the modern person really appreciates the dangerousness of the unconscious until you look at an isolated tribe of people, for example, and see what the unconscious suggests to them to do. You know, to go murder so-and-so because they're a witch, et cetera, et cetera. And then it just really brings it to life when you go back and look at some of the few cultures that are untouched by civilization today.
How dangerous a thing is.
Oh, yeah. One wrong move and...
Yeah, you know, that little group I had trouble with down in North Carolina, a Christian union group, they would sit around and say, now what's the gift of that dream? I said, you've got to be kidding me. No idea of the destructive power. Everything was good coming out of the dream. You know, you probably heard me tell that story of Anthony Stevens, and I got it away from his mouth. He was visiting, I think it was the Maasai in Africa, and the night before, a bunch of guys had went over to the next tribe and hacked one of the guys to pieces. Mm-hmm. And Stephen said, why? And the guy said, because the witch doctor said he was the reason my wife was sick. Mm-hmm. There's the unconscious for you.
Well, we're not doing much better.
Exactly. Axis of evil.
We're just not usually going next door and hacking people up.
We bomb them across the earth.
Yeah. We like to send a drone. More cleanly.
Yeah.
Yes, we send a drone.
It's easier to project onto somebody across the world than your neighbor, because your neighbor can say, hey, wait, I didn't say that. Mm-hmm. Or, hey, wait, I didn't do that. So, you learn to withdraw your projections from certain people, but not from everybody.
I was reading an advertisement from this woman, a couple of women who are medium therapists, and in the introduction to a question at the screen, she said, our society is paleontological in their emotions, medieval in their institutions, and godlike in the technology.
Well, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
I will send it to you guys, and I thought, you know.
Who wrote it? Do you remember?
I can't remember the name. The woman was quoting somebody, and I want to try and get that book, but I'll get that name.
Mm-hmm.
And talk about, if you had a chance, go see the movie that's playing at the Keystone Arts now. Lori, if that happens. It's an unbelievable story about how five children survived after World War II when both their parents were Nazis and had to kill themselves. And so they were trying to find their grandmother. And they had to go to the Black Forest, and there's all these trials and tribulations. But it brings in how a lot of the German people got duped. By Hitler and his message, and totally unconscious. And this young woman, it's amazing that she goes through the realization of what happened. Because she had heard the bright cheery, yes, this is awesome.
Trains run on time.
The fear is so good.
Mm-hmm.
Then she was slowly through the journey. She was discovering what had really happened.
Is it Lorry or?
Lore. And it's in German. With English subtitles, so you probably enjoy it, but it's hard to watch because, you know, whenever you're watching it, subtitles. But it's unbelievable. And talking about old truths dying, I mean, this young woman, who she was the oldest of all these other children, and there was a baby, and it didn't have anything in there. But she came to a realization of, at the end, there's a real powerful scene of that. She's, the old authority isn't working anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Say it that way. It's unbelievable. They do finally find their grandmother. But,
true story?
You know, I was going to go back and review the trailer on a
they did a lot of research. It might have been, and I don't know for a fact.
Based on true story. I'm going to take it. More than I'm going to take it.
But I mean, it's so realistic. I mean, it probably could very well have happened.
Oh, sure.
It was, yeah. There were so many, I mean.
It's a German movie, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it was released first in Germany.
Yeah, it's a European film. Yeah. And it got all kinds of awards, you know, the Cannes Festival and all that. But after World War II, there was just so much. I mean, there's so many people that didn't have homes,
yeah.
Didn't have food. There were just so many refugees all over the place. You know, it was fighting for every piece of bread.
And yep. Then,
depending on which section of Germany they were in, you're in the Russian section, it's really bad, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
The American section is a little more humane.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my first client in Zurich, her earliest memory was her uncle running towards her on fire in the Dresden firebombers. And then that was Eastern Germany, and the Russians came, and they were more afraid of the Russians than anything. Mm-hmm. So she said how she and her mom, I think her dad was killed. Her mom was Swiss. Her dad was German. Came to the border to get into the Western zone, and they couldn't get in. And so her mother had brought all the jewels she had and gave them to the soldier, and the soldier let them in. Probably saved their lives. I mean, that we just can't imagine it. She was like five, and she'll never get over that terror of that kind of stuff. Yeah. Okay. Some of this I understand, some of it I don't, and I'm going to try to lay out things I don't understand. Just right before we stopped last time, she says, your body remains with you, my beloved, your living body. The enlightening thought comes from the body. Well, that's, we've been saying that all along. See, right near the bottom of second column on 339.
Oh, you're already down there?
Yeah, we got that far last time.
Did we? Well,
yeah.
I'm a little confused. I just want to just clarify something.
Yeah.
Up here in the middle where she's talking about Hap.
Yeah.
She says Hap is the light. It's in the light. The other god is night. Now, what do you suppose? Do you suppose she's indicating that Hap is where enlightenment will come from, or understanding, and the other god is now, obscuring understanding?
I don't think necessarily, but what I thought was they're just not, she's not allowing him to forget there were two sides to God.
And then she goes on in the next sentence to say the God of the Spirit is in the night, and she had just said he's in the light.
Well,
or maybe Jung is saying that. It must be Jung. Is that the sun?
What do you? I replied, he's in the light, and the other God is in the light.
Yeah, that's Jung.
We're going to see absolutely contradictory statements in one sentence.
I'm just trying to get it straight in my head, the line of thought that we're going to go on as we go down this column. So right there, I wasn't sure what the blood spirit, if they consider the blood spirit the son of the frogs or the god of in the light, or...
Could you talk a little bit about the son of the frogs?
Me neither.
That was a reference to the previous...
Yeah, previous, I don't think frogs came up before, did it?
Frogs. What did he call it back there?
Did that come up already?
Yeah, right?
Well, I don't remember if it did.
When he's with Philemon and... could be near the Kabiri.
Oh, that far.
Wasn't that where his god was called the son of the frogs?
If you can find it.
Might have been prior to scrutiny. I guess it's not that important. I was just trying to...
Well, keep going.
You serpent, you frog. page 329, right-hand column, the 1, 2, 3, 4th I statement. My soul, do you still exist, you serpent, you frog? There's somewhere it's called the son of frogs, too.
Go ahead.
I just thought, one of the frogs, son of the frogs, here it is, 328. Right column, bottom, it's type, the myth commences, the one that need only be lived, not sun. I subject myself to the sun, the one engendered by sorcery, the naturally born, the son of the frogs. No woman has given birth to him. So he's a symbol of the self, I assume.
Yes.
And this is right after the story of the king and who kills his son and buries him, and so that's supposed to be instructive to Jung about his truth. And his serpent is telling him this story, his soul in serpent form. And so he gets, then we get to his son as the son of frogs. Or I suppose that's his image of the self, is at this point a son of a frog.
Where I would go with it is frogs are slimy, and they're springtime croakers. So his emphasis on the frogs is the same thing as the emphasis on the body. That this experience comes through messy physical experiences, which are nevertheless new births.
And the frog can live in and out of water.
Didn't Jung give Anfaz the frog one time, and then she kept it until her death?
I don't know.
She had a dream right before her death about a frog.
Did she?
And she knew it was Jung talking to her, and it comes to him, her, and that image. It's like a symbol of transformation.
That as well, because of the different stages.
Right, yeah. Many stages. Development in water and out of water.
And that's in that book. That you read?
Yeah, The Fountain of Wisdom.
That's in there, huh?
Yeah, it's the story of that. It's about how she was given this frog by Jung at some point.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
And that was, she kept that. She it was very dear to her. They probably had an exchange of what it meant to them. And then she had a dream right before she died. And she knew it was Jung talking to her.
Well,
getting a message.
Yeah. How long does a frog live?
I wouldn't think very long.
Yeah. They're long lived, and I was kind of wondering. I mean, was it a stuffed frog? Was it, what was it? It's very hard to keep them. They're very, it's hard to imitate the natural circumstances. It can be done. People do it. I mean, and we've gotten better at taking care of amphibians. And so you'll find them selling frogs in pet stores now. And I guess if people are able to keep them on. But they're very dependent on having water and a certain pH and all that stuff.
Wasn't it during medieval times that women who wanted to become fertile would take a frog into the church as an offering? I don't know what that was about, but I know we studied that in the fairy tale book of Von Braun. So that it symbolized fertility.
But
she had a pond, and she had some frogs at all. And she always took people out there.
Had a natural habitat.
Probably in Balligan. She had a house in Balligan.
It probably was there out in the country.
probably met a natural end and was replaced by other frogs.
Yeah, right.
The point is that it became part of the landscape.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a lovely thought. Huh? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Right now, help me find Pepper's Frog. Right now, we're looking at frogs and their evolution, and they're being born with anomalies, a lot of grotesque anomalies that's supposed to indicate the health of the planet. Scientists are looking at them now.
Because particularly the health of the waterways, and for a number of years they've been watching frogs, and frogs have died out almost completely. We almost lost frogs.
Didn't they discover it was some sort of viral disease?
Yeah, I don't know what they...
I'm not sure. I think they
but
found
I know that is something that they monitor
with. Wasn't the water per se, but a new, some sort of virus that's allowed there, methods of allowed to come up in it.
Honeybees and frogs are the things that they're looking at as far as environmental
challenges. They really have something to keep us right now.
It's kind of scary, but in China, you know, those rivers are drying up. And
Thousands
of rivers are drying up.
Mm-hmm. Because of their dams?
Because
of all the dams they've built?
Because their pollution is insane.
Mm-hmm.
Everything's so polluted over there. I mean,
now, how does pollution make the river dry up?
I guess, you know, the earth is rebelling.
There's some climate change going on. There's getting less rain, too.
And all these dead animals are in there. Yeah.
So that's some of this stuff I feel certain about. Some of it I can say, well, here's how I see it. And that's what I'd say about the frog.
Maybe this just strikes me crazy.
It's a tough section.
We will figure it out.
It's like reading Zarathustra.
It is like reading Zarathustra, and I don't know if I could have done this without having read Zarathustra. You think this is bad? You don't read Zarathustra. Nietzsche was insane. Jung was pretty sane.
Crazy stuff.
Like one sentence, there's a complete contradiction. In Zarathustra, in some sentences, there's a complete contradiction. From clause 1 to clause 2. No Santa involved, huh? Now, having said that, I am puzzled by this statement. I recognize no such thought, I said.
Right. Well, that's what she says, the enlightening thought comes out of the body.
Yeah, she says, column 2, 339, about a quarter of the way up, but she said, your body remains with you, my beloved, your living body, the enlightening thought comes from the body. That's what we've been doing for the last 3 years. What are you talking about? I recognize no such thought, I said. I wanted to say, have you not been paying attention?
Maybe it means just right at that moment.
Maybe at that moment. I mean, that is a puzzle. Or maybe he hasn't understood. I'm not sure. But it's a non sequitur, for sure.
I just love that image, that thought crawling around the body like a worm.
Like a worm.
Looking for a way out.
Yes.
That's, you know, there's a worm that Jimmy Carter helped eradicate in Asia and Africa that does that. To get it out, they twist it out on a stick, and it causes tremendous pain. But it eventually goes around the body and comes out somewhere.
Wow.
And it's incredibly debilitating, and Jimmy Carter has, there would be like millions of cases of it. And he managed to bring the technology to people, which is a simple cloth that gets things out of water. So now there's only a few hundred cases every year. That's a worm that goes around the body.
Yeah.
Comes out. It gets into us through water.
Wow.
So the symbolism is very similar here, but then it has no good end.
Yeah. Yeah. We are separate from parasites. I mean, if you live in the third world, I don't think she meant me saying. Mary Kay was saying, she's done operations in mission trip, she'll cut somebody open. Worms will just come out. Because the parasites is just the way of life. And they can't treat them. The reason our medicine is so good because we develop medicine to deal with the issues we have. And we don't have parasites, so we don't have a lot of medicine to combat them. But they have got parasites, but no research to combat them.
Well, we've actually got, what, hundreds of parasites in our body right now, but they're not really harmful. So
our body has lots of bacteria that is useful and good for us.
Yeah, but there are parasites also, right?
The issue with parasites is that basically we develop health departments who sanitize water, sanitize food, and that's where you start with that. And once you... Parasites are something that... I only call it a parasite. Parasites are something that on their host are taking away from it. There are also symbiotic relationships, and we have tons of things that are in our bodies that we have a symbiotic relationship with, and they help us.
I think they're finding out more and more in the research I've been reading that has to do with those things helping us control allergies. And
most of your normal flora of your gut helps you. That's why they're doing a lot of research on nutrition, and the fact that we eat so much sugar and hydrogenated fat changes the bowel flora, and then that causes illness everywhere in the body. And they're thinking that a lot of the illnesses are related to that.
Well, this is a benevolent one.
Yeah.
And that goes back to that image that we've seen before of that worm all through this work.
Right. I would interpret that to say it's really driving home how Jungian psychology starts with the lowest, with the body, with emotions, with problematic relationships to reality. That's the worm. Remember von Franz saying they only want the upper half.
Yeah.
This is the lower half.
I think Jung just simply, he just has a moment of fastidiousness here, where he just sort of balks at the imagery.
Well, that could be.
Yeah, and I need that human reaction from him, or it would all be just too tidy. Mm-hmm. I want to see the real. This is great because we see how the real person.
Mm-hmm.
And when they first encounter things from the unconscious, how it can strike
mm-hmm.
you.
Mm-hmm.
And how it can fall back into the unconscious and then come up again and say, like you said, haven't you been listening? So you only get it after you get it, and then you have to get it again.
And then you get it again. Maybe that's what's going on.
But I don't understand why how it turns into a leech. Or he becomes a leech because of it.
Well, yes. Now... so we get he drinks blood, she drinks blood, that goes back and forth. And I think we're back to the issue of, I think this quote is so important, sometimes one is allowed by the gods to substitute wine for blood, but that will come later. Jung is talking about the woman, his visions, he's interpreting.
Well, if this serpent, this enlightening thought, is within the body, it's in the blood, it is the blood spirit, then you'd have to be a leech to get to it. Perhaps.
And the way I take that is that life is still demanding he go through experiences that cost him dearly.
That's the blood. The leech on the blood spirit.
Yeah, it's just, well, sometimes he feels that she's demanding it, sometimes he feels he's falling into it, but that's what's going on. Now that will start to change.
So would you say that he has to become this leech to have communion with this blood spirit?
Yes, he is paying in blood. He is still paying in blood. But what the scrutinies are about, it's the shift from paying in blood to paying in wine. And that comes from the self. In other words, some insights you can only learn the hard way.
So this is like the transubstantiation in the mass.
We're moving in that direction.
That he must drink the blood experience.
Yeah. And you might say, why is that so important? Because when we do stupid things, I don't know anybody that doesn't beat themselves up for it. Instead of saying, I needed that. There's a beautiful quote in, well, it's in that book of quotes. I don't remember where it originally is, but Jung says something like, the love problem is, you know how that goes? The love problem is...
Oh, you mean the love and power?
No, the one about...
Love problem is part of the heavy burden we have to pay as human beings, and nobody should be ashamed of having paid it.
Yeah.
To pay
homage. Did you talk about
Job
versus the
warning
in this class?
Job versus the warning.
Was that only in Saturday?
No, it's been up here.
Yeah, yeah.
It's been referred to, I don't know.
Yeah, it's in... You may not be familiar with it, Carl. It's in the Vision Seminar. In the Vision Seminar, she's caught in a marriage triangle. And Jung is not encouraging her to get out of it. Not that she would listen if he did. But somebody says, why don't you tell her to get out of this bad relationship? And that's his answer. Because she has to pay in blood now to learn what she has to learn.
She's got to... go the whole route with Murray.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Jung has to go us take the journey fully with
absolutely
with Tony.
Yeah.
In Ann Carson's book, and I haven't really understood this, but she talks about a Greek concept of erotic shame, that when we fall into those, you know, erotic experiences like say she had with Murray, there's a lot of shame involved in that whole process, and that is also part of paying in blood.
Mm-hmm.
But I never thought about that before, erotic shame.
Meaning that something inside you feels that you're diminished by the relationship?
No, she doesn't talk about it that way. I have to bring it and explain, have her explain.
Well, I mean, has anyone ever said, how could I have been so stupid to do that?
Well, that's what I meant by a feeling of diminishment.
Yeah. Oh, well, yeah. And rather than that was a necessary step along the way. And, you know, I think our ideal of health is having no problems versus growing through them.
Some of those right relationships can be not a step along the way, just a big fat mistake.
But if you learn something,
if you maybe you needed that mistake to learn something.
Yeah, and that's what she's saying in this book, that through that, through Eros, then you find something new. There's it's bittersweet because you lose something that you also gain if you take the risk.
Mm-hmm.
Well, but the idea of calling yourself stupid is I think puts an element of caution on the whole thing. Otherwise, people want to say, oh, yeah, everything I do is great.
Yeah.
And the more the better forever. And a little bit of right shame may go a long way.
Right. But if you read this, it might be Socrates. I'll see if I can find it, what he says. How you handle it is an index of the quality, wisdom, and decorum of the things inside you. This is talking about Eros entering you. As you handle it, you come into contact with what is inside of you in a sudden and startling way. You perceive what you are, what you lack, what you could be. According to Socrates, it is a glance down into time at realities you once knew, as staggeringly beautiful as the glance of your beloved. To me, that says a lot about what happens. And that doesn't mean you just, you know, willy-nilly go and jump into bed with everybody that you see, but, you know, there's some wisdom involved in that.
And I think if you do it consciously, you don't want to do it again. That's the difference. It's going from I shouldn't to I really am not interested. And then you don't project your unlived desire on somebody else. So that's what I think, the blood sucking back and forth, all these statements. I don't know if we need to go into them, each statement, because it's a theme that repeats.
So she said, one more thing about the blood.
Yeah.
On that same page, we're on the bottom. Yes, drink blood, suck it up, get your fill from the carcass. Is the carcass his own body?
Yeah, I think it's the mess that's left out of a bad experience.
That's why it's disgusting?
Yes.
Because I was thinking, well, you know, blood is not really what we call it. I don't think of my blood as disgusting. But if there was a foul worm in it, then maybe I'd.
Yeah.
But it says it's nourishing, too. Certainly disgusting, but nourishing. And then she says you should not understand. Yes.
But yeah. Pretty soon he's going to start arguing with her.
Right.
That's the difference.
Right.
So we can't listen to everything she says, nor everything he says. Because we're going to hear he rails at her, she rails at him, and then Philemon comes in and strikes a compromise. So that's why I wasn't going to go into all of these statements, because none of them are totally true.
So Philemon would be the wisdom inside of him,
yeah,
that comes from.
Yeah. That, you know, she has somewhat of a truth. Sometimes you do have to throw caution to the wind. And thanks to Christian morality, that's prohibited. On the other hand, as you've heard me talk about the promiscuity of the day, some people just live her out, never even thinking about, you know, what do I need to learn, or who am I harming, or what rut am I in again? So each of these figures has a truth, but they need to begin listening to each other and accentuating the positive but diminishing the destructive aspect of their respective positions.
Are we now over on 340?
I don't know if we've gotten that far yet.
the railing back and forth is going to be between the, one of these shades, this dead woman.
Right.
So up until Philemon reappears.
Well, the soul appears.
Oh, yes, that's right. And
you see, yeah, we're still with the shade, I think, aren't we?
We have to distinguish between this shade as he first seems to think that she's part of his soul.
Yes.
He wrote of her that way in the black book, is that correct? And then for the red book he became more discriminating.
Yeah. You can almost call this chapter the discriminations.
Equals discrimination.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So now let's look at the second line on 340. She looked at me as she had done on the day I had last seen her among the living. That one puzzles me a little bit as well. I think it means when he believed in Christianity.
Where is that?
Third line, 340, first column.
Oh, I see. I was thinking of the Egyptians who left behind.
Did she think that winged creature that came and talked to him and then went up to heaven? Way back. Somewhere.
I don't think so.
Soul, right?
Yeah. This, you could just say this, you know, let me just preface it. Whenever we define these things, we're oversimplifying it. But if we don't do that, we'll get nothing. So I would say, to be simplistic, she is simply a representation of the truths that Christianity once embodied but have been lost.
And on this Egyptian motif, in the next quote underneath there, she seems to be referring to that initial dream of the, you know, the red sun, the cave, the
we will
river
get there.
Blood.
Yeah.
So maybe she's referring all the way back to the beginning.
Yes.
Of his experience.
Yes, and we'll get there. I'm going to bring that picture back in. Not for a couple pages yet. But I think the sun is the principle of understanding that is going through a change. Once Christianity was alive for him. When it was alive for him, it was a son. It's no longer alive for him. So his son is going through a night sea journey like the Egyptians depicted in the Book of the Dead. That's how I understand it.
The quote, though, but she looked at me, seems to totally fit with what Barbara, I think, is referring back to, which is the whirring sunbeetle. She hears the whirring wings. That's the same woman. The whirring of a sunbeetle.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
She drew near, made a soft whirring sound, the whirring of the sunbeetle. Then I recognized her. But she was still alive. She recovered the mysteries of the Egyptians for me.
Is that what you were referring to, Barbara? Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Sorry, I thought you meant way back when the woman was trying to pull him up to heaven.
She remained shadowy and so forth.
Yes.
That was what I was thinking.
Which,
of.
This one here?
The one you were just saying.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, I don't remember.
So then, and she still represents the fact that she is a connection to the truths of the Egyptians. Why would we think that she might represent his loss of faith in Christianity?
Because the Egyptians were the first to clearly delineate the death and rebirth theme that Christianity picked up.
Well, they give an example for the rebirth of the sun.
Right.
So, aside from what you said, that can simply be the idea that the sun can be reborn, and he's taking what he needs from the ancient thought.
Yeah. Osiris, you know, he descended for 3 days. It's exactly what the Christians picked up for Christ descending. Mm-hmm. And now, since you asked, I'll make it a little more complicated. But you can blame Carl, not me.
People end up blaming here.
Sorry.
As long as we're rejecting shadows, we might as well enjoy it. I think the Christian, the Egyptians, so clearly documented the death and rebirth of the god. That Christianity picked up. So there's a link. The difference is that the Egyptians saw that death and rebirth as a transformation of God. The Christians didn't. So he's drawing back to Egypt for the death and rebirth theme, which is Christian, but adding to it the death and rebirth that he's going through is a transformation of his understanding of God. That's why the Son is referred to. Again, this is just my opinion.
That's really good.
That's just my opinion.
That's really good.
I think I remember him writing, one of the things that frustrated him about Christianity was it does have a dying and rebirthed God, resurrected God, but God doesn't change. Other religions have God dying, coming back different, but not in Christianity. So it didn't have the mythological container that he felt we needed to understand how our image of God needs to change. But the Egyptians provided that.
Well, for them, in the death of the sun every day, there was
right.
That was inherent in the way they lived.
Yeah.
that the God went into the underworld and then transformed and brought something new each day.
And the reason he went into the underworld was he was inadequate. But in Christianity, Christ isn't inadequate.
Right.
He was just killed. So that...
Perfect.
Perfect. So that transformed the idea of the transformation of God image, which he doesn't have yet figured out, but I think we can see he's wrestling with images which will later be the foundation of his idea. Our idea of God needs to change, and that's not a totally new idea, it's just foreign to Christianity.
So what's happening here through his blood experience is not just personal. It's happening.
Right.
It's a cultural thing that he has to come to grasp
right.
with as well.
Right.
I took it also as a personal thing, and this is how I kind of got there. I saw this woman as he's dealing with her as if she's kind of a witch, a negative person. And we had talked about the dead also being the ancestors.
Yeah.
And when I was looking at her as a witch, I started looking through Wikipedia at Baba Yaga, who's one of the... I like that image of the witch who can be very destructive, but also gives fire, can sometimes be cooperative, and all that. And as I went through that, I found a reference to Fra Hall.
Paula.
And in German ancestry, I decided to go through that link. And at the very bottom of the Wikipedia thing, it talked about Frau Hall was the symbol that Martin Luther, who started Lutheranism and the sport in Christianity and all that, used for hostile reasons in theological context. And I thought, you know, he worked so much on Christianity because his father was a minister. He wasn't part of the Lutheran, but he was part of that split, and then the secondary split that went later. But this woman who's coming at him as a witch would also be the symbol of what he would do in answer to Job. He would use reason to deal with the death and the death of God. So that's how I was working with this section.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Well, we've covered all of four sentences. Maybe we should take a break.
Yeah. Breathe.